say, not to get too detail-oriented, but that sometimes there's a difference in how many, you know, sort of starchy vegetables, potatoes mostly, and grains like rice.
Dr. Brogan, unfortunately, we're out of time, but I just wanted to say...
Yeah, because I was going to really dive in, so it's probably good you cut me off.
Thanks for being here.
Ferment is the answer.
Thanks for being on Health Watch today.
Thank you. Total pleasure. Take care.
We're talking today to psychiatrist Dr. Kelly Brogan about her book, A Mind of Your Own, The Truth About Depression and How Women Can Heal Their Bodies to Reclaim Their Lives. You've been listening to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host.
Cabu at the Clinton is our monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater. This month, on Thursday, April 14th at 7 p.m., Cabu at the Clinton will show Who Are My People? Who Are My People is a documentary film which follows four Native American elders as they seek to preserve cultural resources, including large geoglyphs from the building of renewable energy facilities in California's Mojave Desert. Director Robert Lundahl will be in attendance. Again, that's Who Are My People, Thursday, April 14th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland.
And you know it takes all of us to keep KBOO strong. Did you know you can give gifts of stock to KBOO? We're able to quickly turn these donations into support for the important daily work of KBOO. How do you do this? Call 503-231-8032 or email development@kboo.org for information on how to make a stock gift or a gift of appreciated securities. And thank you, KBOO members and listeners. Now we're going to listen to Madness Radio.
What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, sponsored by peer-run support communities Freedom Center, The Icarus Project, and Portland Hearing Voices. Madness Radio can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network and is online at kboo.fm/madnessradio. Thanks for joining us today on Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. Today, my guest is Dr. Raymond Tallis. Dr. Tallis is a clinical neuroscientist and physician of gerontology. He was named by The Economist magazine as one of the world's top living polymaths and was also named by Prospect magazine as one of Britain's top 100 intellectuals. He's a poet, a novelist, and a short story writer, and he's also the author of recent books, Michelangelo's Finger and The Kingdom of Infinite Space, and most recently, The Defense of Wonder. He's also the author of Aping Mankind, Neuromania, Darwinitis, and The Misrepresentation of Humanity. And we're going to be speaking with Dr. Tallis about biological reductionism. So welcome to Madness Radio, Ray Tallis.
Hello there.
I want to really thank you for coming on the show. I just recently discovered your work, and I was saying before, I'm very, very impressed because you come from the background of a neuroscientist and also practicing a physician who works with dementia patients and geriatrics. And so you're very, very familiar with the clinical side of things, but you're also really involved with theory and philosophy, and especially recently critiquing this biological reductionism that is so rampant in society. And it reduces the mind with all of its complexities, all of its mysteries, and all of its wonder and amazement into just a simple machine that is explained by brain science. And of course, that's something that we talk about and critique quite a bit, the biological model of the mind and biological reductionism in psychiatry. So I'm very happy to have you on the show. Now, Ray, how did you get started and interested in this topic? How did you go from being a clinical neuroscientist and physician to getting interested in theory and critiquing biological reductionism?
Well, my interest in medicine and my interest in philosophy have equal antiquity. I mean, I was interested in philosophy from early teens, and I knew I wanted to be a doctor in my early teens. So the two have run in parallel, really. And I can remember my poor tutor at Oxford when I was a medical student there having to listen to my philosophical critique of some aspects of the neurophysiology that we learned at Oxford. He was an extremely patient and a courteous man. So it is, in a sense, that the two strands of my interest have developed in parallel, and I would say have equal antiquity.
So even from the beginning of your studies, you were not agreeing with a lot of what you were being taught around neurophysiology as explaining experiences in the mind.
Absolutely right. The reason I think I didn't get a first-class honours degree at Oxford, I'm sure there are many other reasons, was that I completely fouled up a question on memory and the neurophysiology of memory. And my own feeling was you couldn't actually have a neurophysiology of memory. And that was my answer, which, of course, would be scored very low in a neurophysiology department. And I think that was, frankly, without trace when I was hoping to get a first. So I've been sort of involved in this quarrel for a very long time.
And I want to say it's also very significant, Ray, that your interests are so wide-ranging. I mean, you're a poet, you're a novelist, and you were described as one of the world's top living polymaths, which means someone who has expertise and interest as an intellectual in many, many different fields. Before we get into the work that you've been doing on biological reductionism, just give us a sense of that sort of scope of your intellectual endeavors, because it's quite impressive.
Well, I suppose that there's two dimensions to it. One is very positive and the other is somewhat negative. The positive dimension is I have an overwhelming sense of the wonder and complexity of the world. And I do so from the standpoint of an atheist humanist. But that's a sort of positive side. As a result of which, I'm very hostile to those who try and reduce us, whether they reduce us biologically, as I'm sure we'll talk about in due course, or whether they reduce us as the theorists, people like Lacan and Derrida, who tried to reduce humanity to sets of signs and to deny our individual agency and so on. So there's been a positive drive, a sense of joy of the complexity of the world and in particular of human beings, and a considerable crossness about the way academics in various fields have had tried to reduce us with their simplifying frameworks.
Well, let's talk about this question of biological reductionism, and that's really the thesis of your book, Aping Mankind, Neuromania, Darwinitis, and the Misrepresentation of Humanity. Tell us about that.
Well, you're absolutely right. Its central target is not biology. Biology is one of the great achievements of the human intellect, but biologism, the idea that we can be understood as organisms, that people are essentially organisms. And biologism has two strands, as illustrated in the title of the book. One is neuromania, and that is the idea that we are our brains, that our consciousness is identical with neural activity, and you can understand our behavior by looking at our brains. If you really want to understand human beings and what motivates them and so on and so forth, you peer into the intracranial darkness using techniques like functional magnetic resonance imaging or brain scans. So that's one dimension. The other dimension is Darwinitis. Now, Darwinism is fine. Darwin's theory of evolution is one of the most, probably the greatest idea anybody's ever had. But Darwinitis is something quite different. Darwinism says that explains the processes by which the organism Homo sapiens came into being. Darwinitis says those same processes explain what people are. And actually, I don't think that's the case. I think people are not identical with organisms. And I say that not because I have a religious agenda or because I believe in something, an immaterial soul, but because I look at what's in front of my nose, which is that people are entirely different from all other forms of living matter.
Now, this is why I have you on the show, is because these two approaches that we can understand the mind by taking a picture of the brain using a magnetic resonance image, or that we can take a look at theories of brain chemistry and neurons, and that we can explain what human experience is about, that's become almost common sense. I mean, it's a widespread assumption in all of approaches to psychology and in popular culture. And also there's this idea of evolutionary psychology, the idea of Darwinitis that you're calling it, that if we just understand how primitive human beings evolved into maximizing our fitness, that we are seeking other people in order to carry on the reproduction of our genes in this survival of the fittest framework, that has become so ubiquitous, so widespread in the culture that it's not ever critiqued. And then you're going directly against that. You're saying actually there's a fundamental flaw in both of those perspectives, this idea of biological reductionism.
I think, and you've put your finger on it, it's become so ubiquitous that it almost seems like common sense to many people. And to oppose it seems like opposing the blindingly obvious. But when we look a little bit closer at the claims of people who, as it were, advance neuromania, or we look at evolutionary psychologists, they disintegrate. One of the most talked about areas of aspects of neuromania has been social neuroscience. This is the use of neuroscience to explain the nature of love, of beauty, of wisdom, to say exactly what religious beliefs are, to explain or to find new ways in which we can determine whether people have criminal responsibility for their actions and so on and so forth. This has become very widespread indeed. But if you look more closely, you can see it disintegrates.
What are some examples of that? I'm thinking, for example, the search for the God area of the brain, or the idea that people are motivated to love because of the release of certain kinds of chemistries, of chemicals in the brain that give us good feelings, and therefore this explains why we fall in love.
Those are two terrific examples. I mean, first of all, the notion that we can explain religious belief in terms of neural activity, and that there has been a God spot implanted in our brains by evolution, because religion apparently is very good for making sure we get on together well. History actually doesn't support that, but never mind. But there are those who believe there is a God spot in the brain. And one of the bases for that is discovering that certain people who have epilepsy sometimes have experiences that appear to have a religious dimension to them. Well, I have to tell you, I did epilepsy clinics for 20 years, and I never had a patient whose seizures resulted in a religious conversion. This is a very good example of the kind of reductionism that one sees in neuromania, because religious beliefs are not just about simple, isolated experiences, bursts of feeling. They're about doctrines and creeds. They're about commitments to ethical codes. They're about observances and so on and so forth. Most of those who believe that you can neuralize religion actually miss the complexity and the profundity of religion. You wouldn't get a cathedral out of a whole pile of brains spiking off, you know, in particular places. And although I'm an atheist, I feel quite protective towards God when he's reduced by neurotheologians to spiking of certain areas in the brain. So that's one very good example that you've pointed to.
But what would you make of the fact that there is this correlation that some magnetic resonance images, brain scans, have claimed to make between religious experiences and certain parts of the brain, so-called lighting up? What do you make of that correlation that's so often claimed between brain activity and conscious experience?
Well, first of all, there's a philosophical point that correlation is not causation. Even less is it identity. So just because when somebody is having a moment of religious experience where a particular part of the brain lights up, doesn't mean to say their religious experience is their brain lighting up. But of course, religious experiences are things that we, if we have an experience, we ourselves interpret it. We interpret it in the light of our culture. If I had a most wonderful feeling, I'd be much more inclined, if I moved in a particular religious setting, to attribute it to an experience of God than I would if I was in a non-religious culture. So in other words, what happens, the sort of feelings that people may have, aren't sufficient to generate religious beliefs. Somehow the interpretation has to come from without. And that without is the community of minds to which we belong, which the standalone brain gives us an entrance ticket to, but doesn't encompass. Does that make sense?
So there's still this gap between the physical, say, physiological experience and then what the mind makes of it. And that is, I guess, is called the hard question in consciousness studies. How does what we call awareness or consciousness arise supposedly from this foundation of brain activity? And that has never been explained by any of the neuroscience theories.
You're quite right. And the hard question goes deeper than these higher level things like religion. It goes right down to straightforward things like the fact that I can experience your voice as a sound, that there's, you know, the taste of wine, the feeling of warmth on one's hands, that itself is quite different from any neural activity. So that's the hard question. And quite a lot of those philosophers who want to believe that neuroscience explains these fundamental ground floor contents of consciousness, they actually sort of feel very uncomfortable about precisely those contents of consciousness. They deny the existence of what philosophers would call qualia. They say, oh, qualia, they're just folk psychological constructs. But actually, you and I both know that the feeling that we have when we're drinking a glass of wine or looking at the sun is hardly a folk psychological construct.
So you're identifying there are all these logical fallacies that are at the basis of a lot of our neuroscience explanations for the human consciousness and the mind.
There are, and some of them are quite subtle fallacies. For example, John Searle, who's a pretty good philosopher, says the relationship between neural activity and consciousness is like the relationship between molecules of H2O and water. Now, molecules of H2O aren't shiny and slippery, but water is shiny and slippery. But water is nothing more than molecules of H2O. So that's the relationship we have. That illustrates the relationship between neural activity and conscious experience. The trouble is that that kind of analogy relies on importing consciousness from the outside. Of course, water looked at one level is molecules, and looked at or experienced another level is all shiny and slippery. But note looked at. In other words, the two levels at which water is on the one hand H2O and on the other hand shiny and slippery rely on consciousness. So you can't use this as a model for the relationship between neural activity and consciousness.
If you're just tuning in, this is Madness Radio, and we're speaking with Dr. Raymond Tallis. He's a clinical neuroscientist and physician of gerontology, who was named by The Economist magazine as one of the world's top living polymaths. He's the author of Aping Mankind, Neuromania, Darwinitis, and the Misrepresentation of Humanity. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. You quoted the writer Matt Crawford as saying that brain scans are, quote, the fast-acting solvent of critical faculties, unquote.
It's such a lovely quote, isn't it? You know, I really wish I'd thought of that myself. Anyway, I'm pleased to disseminate that marvelous statement. And you can see the kind of critical, I'll come back again, and the way he was referring to experiments in so-called social neuroscience, where using magnetic resonance imaging and other brain scanning techniques, people think they can identify the nature of love. And I want to give you an example of an experiment which is so crude, I'm sure it'll make your listeners fall about laughing. This is an experiment carried out by Samir Zeki and his colleagues. They wanted to know what the nature of love was. So what they did was they showed some subjects pictures of people they were in love with, and they showed the subjects pictures of people who were just acquaintances. And then they subtracted the brain activity in the second case from the brain activity in the first case. And what remained counted as romantic love. Well, those of us who are not Martians or neuromaniacs know that love doesn't consist of a simple response to a stimulus. It consists of many, many things, including not being in love at that moment, worrying about what the loved one is thinking, imagining relationships and meetings, and, you know, extraordinarily complicated, as well as all the sort of basic lust and awe and joy and so on. The idea you can reduce love, romantic love, to the response to a stimulus is exactly the kind of reductionism that biologism, and in particular neuromania, specializes in.
What are some of the other claims that neuromania makes that seem very attractive and then might almost seem like common sense until you actually start scrutinizing them?
Well, there are the claims that neuroscience can help us to replace the untidy judicial processes that we have at the moment in determining criminal responsibility with a biological justice. And how can you determine whether somebody can be held responsible for an action that they did? Well, you put their head in a brain scan, and you can look at the activity in the frontal lobe, which controls your behavior and is pro-social, and you can look at the activity in the amygdaloid body, which is impulsive and can sometimes be antisocial. And if a person has too much activity in the amygdaloid body and not enough activity in the frontal lobe, they cannot be held responsible for whatever crime they did.
So if you just identify neurologically, oh, this is a impulse part of the brain that's driving this behavior, then somehow the person is off the hook because their brain made them do it in a sense.
Exactly. My brain made me do it. The brain's in the dock, and please, you know, judge my brain. But of course, trying to decide what are normative data for the balance between the amygdala body and the frontal body, frontal lobes, requires actually referring to all the usual methods we use for determining criminal responsibility. So there have been studies on psychopaths and looking at the balance between their frontal lobes and their amygdala lobe bodies and seeing whether it's different from that of other people. First of all, the differences aren't great. Secondly, those differences may be the result not of any psychopathic tendency, but of the life that people have lived. And thirdly, you have to arrive at the decision that someone's a psychopath, not using brain scans at all, but by using the normal behavioral and historical and interview techniques that we would use before. So the brain scan brings nothing new to the party.
All those diagnostic criteria we talk about on Madness Radio, of course, being very culturally constructed. What might be considered psychopathic behavior in one culture might be considered like great leadership in another culture, for example.
You're absolutely right. And that's precisely what I mentioned. You mentioned that the cultural sensitivity, that's precisely what's missing. You can't, by peering into the intracranial darkness of a standalone brain, make any judgment of the appropriateness of someone's behavior, because exactly as you said, what is regarded as appropriate or good or desirable behavior in one culture may be regarded as inappropriate, bad, and undesirable. Yeah. In another culture.
Yeah, it depends on the context and the culture. And something that we talk about quite a bit is the early days of psychiatric diagnosis. I mean, you mentioned dementia and you mentioned your work as in geriatric medicine, working with brains and as a clinical neuroscientist. I mean, clearly there's some relationship between the health and the well-being of the brain and someone's health and well-being as a person. There's a clear relationship. But what happened, I think, early in the diagnostic development of the clinical categories by Emil Kraepelin and the early psychologists and psychiatrists was that they mixed in people that we would now know to have organic brain problems with those that would not actually have anything that would show up under any kind of physical scrutiny of their brains. So, for example, you recognize that there is a role, obviously, in consciousness and affecting consciousness of something like dementia, but that doesn't necessarily mean that all experiences of human distress or human difference can be reduced to some kind of malfunction in the brain. We can't actually see if we look at it.
Absolutely. I mean, there are certain obvious principles that in order for me to have the slightest tingle of sensation or the most exquisitely constructed sense of self, I have to have a brain in some kind of working order. If you chop my head off, my IQ falls. Right. Or bash me on the head, I lose consciousness. The brain is a necessary condition of what would be regarded as normal behavior or behavior that enables one to live happily and with others and so on and so forth. It isn't a sufficient condition. It isn't the whole story. And nor is it even when someone has a brain illness. Dementia clearly is an organic psychosis, as you were sort of alluding to. There is a clear correlation between cognitive impairment, behavioral, abnormal behavior, and all sorts of markers, like the loss of cholinergic pathways in different parts of the brain and so on and so forth. So there's an organic psychosis where there's a clear correlation between the manifestations of this psychiatric illness and what you can see in the brain. But even then, still the person who has the illness is not entirely identified with brain activity with the illness. Different people have dementia in different ways. They find their own very tricky path through this awful experience in different ways. They never cease to be persons who are not simply identical with organisms. When it comes to conditions such as schizophrenia and depression, the relationship between brain disturbance and the experience of the person and the manifestation of the illness becomes even less clear-cut. And I think it's very important to appreciate that. Having said that, I mean, so medication and a biological understanding has an important contribution, very obvious in the case of dementia, a little more complex in the case of schizophrenia or depression, but it's not the whole story.
Well, let's talk about the use of Darwin and evolutionary theory to explain human behavior, because that's the other aspect of your book, Aping Mankind, is critiquing that. Give us some examples of the way in which the biological reductionism works in the context of evolutionary explanations.
Yes. I mean, it's worthwhile saying, I mean, just to reiterate, that Darwin's theory is probably one of the greatest, best ideas anyone's ever had. So there's nothing wrong with Darwinism. Organisms have been generated by the process of natural selection on spontaneous variation. Are human beings organisms in the way that chimpanzees are organisms? Mm-hmm. When you've described a chimpanzee as an organism, you've completed the story of a chimpanzee. When I've described you as an organism, I've hardly even begun, because we live not as organisms, but as people in communities of minds. And we have all sorts, we live not merely in a biosphere, but in a senior sphere, a sphere of signs. We live in institutions, we're affected by social facts. Every single biological given is transformed in human beings. Take so-called feeding. I mean, there's a difference between an animal feeding and our eating. Our eating is regulated by the calendar and the clock. It is very much a ritualistic, in many cases, exercise. We have a grammar of what food goes with what other food, and so on and so forth. We bring food from all the four quarters of the earth to eat. So our eating is totally different from an animal feeding. And I've focused on that, really, because people, when they try and say we're different animals, tend to point out rather high-end things, such as symphonies and fretting over transfinite numbers and so on. But I think our differences from beasts are absolutely wall-to-wall. It applies to feeding, it applies to learning, it applies to defecation, it applies to our attitude to death, and so on and so forth. And it seems to me, in order to refute evolutionary psychology, you just have to look at what's in front of your nose. You have to look at the difference between an hour in a library and an hour in the jungle, or an hour in an operating theater and an hour in the savannah. Total difference.
And so that idea that we're not just part of nature, but we're actually part of the semiosphere, we're inside of a meaning-generated language, cultural experience that we cannot get out of, that's the essence of who we are. What are some examples of the way in which evolutionary explanations are used to explain human behavior? Because I think that it starts to drift into another misuse of Darwin, which was social Darwinism and the eugenics movement, which is essentially a way of explaining away very, very nasty hierarchies and human abuse in terms of, well, the stronger should be the ones who survive, the fitter are the ones who should be on top.
That's absolutely right. But of course, that's actually bad biology. As Franz de Waal has pointed out, many animals do actually cooperate. He's looked at the pro-social behavior in chimpanzees, and it isn't a question of the survival of the fittest and dog eat dog and so on. Even in the animal kingdom, that particular notion that we will only get better and better by destroying the weaker amongst us has clearly had appalling consequences in the last century, and who knows, may come back again to haunt us. I mean, the one that amuses me most is the appeal to Darwinism to explain our economic behavior. You know, that we have a brain that was evolved in order to enable us to survive in the Pleistocene era. And in that era, you had to take everything at once. You couldn't wait. And that's why we always have unwise consumption, patterns of consumption. Because the amygdaloid body that says, I want it now, isn't sufficiently suppressed by the frontal lobes, which says, wait until you can afford it. Because the frontal lobe and the amygdaloid body, as it were, established their relationship back in the Pleistocene era. And I do find it very amusing that people explain the credit crunch, for example, in terms of the biology of the brain as it was defined or determined or shaped in the Pleistocene era. Of course, the reason these subprime mortgages arose was because of a change in the regulations regarding mortgages.
You're not critiquing Darwin, you're critiquing the misuse of Darwin's theories, so that we don't want to lead into some assumption that all of Darwin isn't useful and therefore the only thing, other option that we have is creationism, for example.
Oh, absolutely. And I would hate it to be thought in the Pacific that I was a creationist nutter or subscribed to intelligent design. I think both of those ideas are utterly empty.
What do you think are some promising directions for research in consciousness that you do think might be more illuminating rather than misleading?
Well, the first thing is people are starting to look outside the brain. They're talking about the embodied mind. So suddenly the body has been discovered. Yippee. And people have also started discovering what they call the extended mind, and Andy Clark and so on have referred to supersizing the mind, and that starts to incorporate the environment in which a human being lives and has their being. And that acknowledges at least that consciousness is a relational thing. It's about our relationship to a body, to an environment, to others, and you can't take one of those for a larger way without getting rid of consciousness.
Ray, we don't have much time left in the interview. Can you just remind us the names of your recent books and how people can get in touch with you if they want more information about your work?
Oh, thank you. Well, I have a website, which is www.raymondtallis.com. And the most recent, I mean, you've mentioned Aping Mankind, which brings together a lot of my preoccupations about biologism. In Defense of Wonder, which has just come out today, is really an attempt to show the place of philosophy in our understanding of the world and enriching our understanding of the world. A philosophy that's not, on the one hand, guru goo, or on the other hand, a thousand dusty footnotes, you know, chased down a labyrinth of various responses.
Raymond Tallis, thank you for joining us today on Madness Radio.
Oh, it's been an absolute pleasure, and thank you very much indeed.
You've been listening to an interview with Dr. Raymond Tallis. He's a clinical neuroscientist and physician of gerontology who was named by The Economist magazine as one of the world's top living polymaths and named by Prospect magazine as one of Britain's top 100 intellectuals. He's a poet, novelist, and a short story.
And now, the KBOO News at noon for Monday, April 4th, 2016. In local news, Portland air quality activists have begun protesting near the Southeast Portland Precision Cast Parts plant. The plant, located at Southeast 46th and Harney near Johnson Creek, opened in 1957 and makes titanium, nickel, cobalt, and steel alloys for jet engines and nuclear power plants. In December, the U.S. EPA released a report showing the area around the plant was a toxic hotspot, and residents in the area had a slightly increased cancer rate. In 2013, a University of Massachusetts research institute named the Precision Cast Parts Corporation as the number one toxic polluter in the entire nation. Recent water testing in Johnson Creek near Precision Cast Parts showed the water was contaminated with a toxic slough containing cobalt, hydrofluoric acid, sodium hydroxide, copper, lead, nickel, zinc, and arsenic.